Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Dieter Meyer from Yellow, this is obviously a massive pleasure to be talking to you. I want to first of all start about talking about your early life and about what sort of music your parents listened to and what sort of creative influences were around you at that period.
Well, period is a good word, but the beginning of going to university was very strange because I didn't like it, and I did all kinds of things. Like I was a semi-professional poker player. I was traveling. I did a lot of things that were pretty useless, and I had to find myself at the beginning of my whole, let's call it, of my whole being.
You were born towards the end of the Second World War, and obviously Switzerland was a neutral country, so it wasn't in the war. But there must have been, and I talked to Wolfgang Fleur about this from Kraftwerk, and he talked about how his political leanings were formed because of being of that generation, and also in terms of sort of cultural aspects and so on. How was that for you?
Well, of course, I was a student of law. I wasn't really doing a lot there, but I was definitely a part of a movement of people, of my friends, who did not agree with what happened in Switzerland and how big the scale was between poor people and people who were very wealthy. And basically, after all these years, we still have the same a system. Maybe it's a little better for the poor people, but poor people had a very tough time at that time. And I was part of protesting against this with many different means. I had lots of street ideas that I did and so forth, but I don't want to really talk about it. It's too simple. It doesn't interest me to go back to this. I had a lot of street theater things that I did with a group of people, and that was my contribution, my little contribution, which of course was not very important at the day. At the day.
Did your parents value a creative life?
Oh, absolutely. They knew exactly what I was doing, and they gave me all the freedom. They were very confident that I would make my way. And there was never ever a discussion, Dieter, are you really studying the law, and how is it going, or any pushing thing. My parents were happy that I had a good relationship with the whole family. And even though I went on another path, another road, I mean, there were discussions, of course, but very productive and good discussions.
You mentioned that you became a poker player. But what is it about poker, could you say, that it gave you in a positive way? And what did a dependency to gamble leave you with?
Well, poker is a total escape from the real world. You know, if you are a poker man, you are like under a glass, how should I say, a glass wall. The whole world around you doesn't count anymore, because each time you get your cards is like a new life, and you have to make decisions. What do I do now with my cards? So I learned a lot playing poker.
Did the dependency to poker leave you with, was that sort of difficult to get away from, this dependency?
The what?
The dependency, because you've talked about gambling before, and in essence, it's a dependency, like, you know, drugs are a dependency or anything.
No. Drugs were not an issue. My only, how should I say, my only leaving the normal society was not there, because I was a professional gambler. I mean, 4 or 5 times in the week, I was gambling from 9 in the evening till 5 in the morning. And when there was no poker party, I felt like a lost dog and was strolling around town and didn't know what to do with myself.
You were brought up in a wealthy family, and you were a millionaire by the time you went to university, I've read. So, and you became an artist. So why do we generally believe that art can be only created by the poor?
Well, this is not the case. I mean, a lot of artists came from very wealthy families and made a big career, and a lot of people with no background also made a big career. Even when you don't need to make money because you have to win as an artist, you're even more hungry than the wealthy guy who does not is not showing how good he is as a so-called artist. You know, I was lucky that people, I did a lot of pieces on the street, and some important gallery museums, they gave me the opportunity to show what I could show. The first time, when I was quite young, I had a show just for me at the Kunsthaus, and I was very surprised, because until that, all my so-called art pieces happened on the street. I did lots of things on the street, and they thought it was kind of interesting. And then I was at the Museum of Zurich, and in 72 I was invited to Documenta and so forth. And of course, it was a luxury that making money was not my first issue. My first issue was sort of finding myself in what I did. You know, and it wasn't, how should I say, a hunger to become big and famous. The only thing that made a difference for me was that I was always happy when I had an important exhibition, because this was nice for my parents, because my parents could not really follow what this guy was doing. But when I had the chance to have an important show in a museum, they could read from that I must not be just a crazy nutcase who does strange things on the street.
Did you have a mentor in any way, or, you know, a particular person, or through books, or did you achieve things by doing?
Very much by doing, and my street pieces were pretty absurd, and it was dealing with the total nothingness. You know, everything I did made no sense whatsoever. It was just there because I wanted to be there, and I had no other reason to put anything somewhere.
I mean, one of the ones you did, and you've mentioned already a couple, but in 69, you sat in a public place and counted 100,000 pieces of metal. So what was the reaction to this?
Well, the reaction was quite surprising. A lot of people came there and they wanted to know, what is this guy doing? It was on a public square. And very funny was that an elderly group of people, they wanted to ask me, what is it exactly you are doing? And of course, I was not talking to anybody. And then they were going around this framed circle where I had my pieces of metal. And I was sitting on a box, on a wooden box. And then the husband of this lady went a little down, and he was reading from that box, import, export. And the both were very happy that they had a solution, what this guy was doing, import, export. But of course, it was not import, export. It was totally useless, you know.
But art is a brave occupation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, you have to be brave, yeah. But very funny it was that these street pieces I did, that they were discussed and they appeared in newspapers, and people were sort of trying to find out what the hell is this guy really doing, because it was absolutely without any, as I told you, without any mission for anything. I loved the fact that what I did was just there because I wanted it to be there, and for no other reason, that I had made this decision that I want to do this, and there was absolutely total emptiness and no way was something behind it. It was useless.
You mentioned the art piece in Kassel, which was in 1972, and that was about returning one day to do the completion of that work. Who turned up at the station when you did return?
Well, there were a lot of people. There were hundreds of people, but most people, because in the meantime, you know, it was 72. I put this iron memorial plate, which said that 22 years later, I will be back here on a Friday or whatever afternoon. And a lot of people were reading this, and a lot of people were crossing the path there. And they were reading this plate, and it was like a memento mori, you know. It was like, be aware of when your life is over. And it was quite moving that hundreds of people came there, and they wanted to see who is this guy who promised that he will stand on a plate 22 years later. But for a lot of people, it made sense, you know. They had to think that what is going to happen with me in 22 years. And the people wanted to, after I was over for this 1 hour, people wanted to have signed a lot of things. And of course, for a lot of people, it was also important, because in the meantime, working with Boris Blank, I was a kind of a singer or an artist, a verbal artist or whatever. And a lot of people loved our music, and maybe a lot of these people, they came just to see Dieter Meier and Boris Blank, because at that time we did not perform in public.
You mentioned earlier about poker, and I just wondered what art has taught you about humanity that poker didn't.
Well, poker is a very honest game. And it's a mind game, of course, and it's just like any other type of work, you know. It's not, and as I told you, it's a total escape from the so-called real world. But part of it by now is that being a professional poker player, that's a job like any other job, whether you are working in the stock exchange or as a truck driver or whatever, you know, you do your job, and playing poker, you do your job. That was what it was all about, nothing else.
So let's move on now in terms of music, and Cry for Fame. How did that track come about? It's a track that feels really way ahead of its time.
Well, Cry for Fame, of course, was a little bit of a joke, because I was not a professional singer at all. And I because I couldn't really hit the notes correctly. I started to do a lot of rhythm with my voice, which finally then, when I worked with Boris Blank, went to standing at the machine every day for all my life and used to do it and I needed, you know. And this was kind of a pre-rap situation. And we were spearheading Boris's wonderful sounds, his wonderful rhythm and music, and my sort of minimal, I wouldn't even call it singing. I was more of a rhythm guy, you know. And Cry for Fame was a self-ironic situation I couldn't care less. I was not interested in a true cry for fame. He was just making fun of myself that we would like cry. And I was very loud on stage. I could, when I had a gig with my punk situation, I couldn't sing again for at least 3 or 4 weeks because I was just crying. But for fame was fun, you know.
But that was the track that actually brought you to Boris Blank and Carlos Peron, wasn't it? It was the thing that triggered a meeting and led you to their flat. Can you tell me about that?
Well, there was a nice, very small shop in Zurich of a guy who had come into Switzerland. He was from, I think, Czechoslovakia, and he had always the best and newest records. And Boris was a fan of music, and he spent a lot of time in this little shop. And he knew that this guy, a very nice guy, by the way, he was the first who was producing me and my punk band and was publishing it or made a single of it. I think we made about 150 or 200 pieces. And then Boris was encouraged that something as basic as my way of singing, that he would be a much better musician. And he went to see this guy, Weisabel was his name, and said, well, listen to my music, I'm much better than Dieter Meier. I'm much, much better. And then Weibel said, well, I mean, if you're much better, but I don't want you, I produce you, but I don't want you to have a so-called professional singer. You have to have a different singer that works much better for your music than a guy who is just another type of pop singer or whatever, or the singer. And Boris did not like that, but it was the only way how he could produce his first single. And it was very funny how it came about. We recorded this partly in where he lived, and I was shouting so loud that they lost their flat. But then we went to a real studio and did this this first thing, Cry for Fame.
But I read that you actually had to convince them that you were the right person to work with them after that.
Convince, I was not trying to be pushy, standing at the machine every day for all my life and used to do it and so forth. You know, this was a totally new thing, which much later, some years later, was leading to big success in the United States.
So what did you actually think of Boris's music? And how open was he to have someone add to his style?
Well, Boris was living his life inside music. You know, he was a truck driver to make a little bit of money. And 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he had a free hours until like midnight every day, every time. And he was just living his music. For him, his music was the oxygen that made him alive, you know. And of course, somebody who was so devoted, since he was a little boy, actually, he created all kinds of strange rhythms and strange sounds. And he was I call him a musical painter. And the interesting thing of his approach to this was that he did not compose something and then produce it, but like a painter, he started in the left corner and started to play. I'm translating this now into an invention. He started to produce a rose, and at the end of his process, he saw a camel on the canvas, and he surprised himself. This is something very important, that he did not have a clear idea when he started, but he was kind of thrown into his own approach, into his own music, step by step. And he was a little bit like a child in a sand pit that was surprised when somewhere a little castle was suddenly visible. And he surprised himself. When I met him, he had hundreds of cassettes, because he produced a piece more or less every evening when he came home from work. But he never really played this to anybody. You know, he was maybe too shy. Maybe he didn't want it to be disturbed by his work. He didn't want it to hear or to get into a conversation, whether he was good or not so good or whatever. And this made him so interesting, but he really lived his own musical life without looking to the left or to the right. He was living in his world.
So in terms of what you say there about him living in his work and not looking to the left or right, how much of an equal role could you play at the beginning?
Well, as I told you, I was not really a trained or very talented singer. I had a good idea of rhythm, of Boris's great pictures. You know, that was obviously an interesting symbiosis. And the most important thing was, and we did not artificially look for that, but the most important thing was that we did it our way. Nobody had ever done something, neither Boris's music nor my limited singing.
Let's go on to the albums, because you've now released these six albums on vinyl with 12 inches, photos and memories. What is the idea? What do you want to impart with all these photos and memories and this collection?
Well, this was something Boris kind of liked, and I was not really involved in that, because I'm never looking back, you know. I mean, from all the yellow pieces, hardly ever I have looked back and have listened to the music I did, but this is the case for what I'm writing, and it is the case for everything I do. I see this as footsteps. But I never look back. I mean, I go on, and for years I don't produce anything. I'm totally useless. And then suddenly some other footsteps somehow appear.
And in this, you include photos of your respective wives. Is this in a way to honor their role in your success? And what has been that role?
No, that was not of any importance. It was just fun. Like had my little daughters acting in some of acting. I mean, they just had fun. They were like children. They were children. And the fact that our wives also appeared eventually, Patricia much more than Monica, in our music. But it was not a planned concept that we now promote our wives. It was just like having fun with Patricia and Monique, my wife, and if they liked to be part of it, okay, jump into the world of Boris Blank, and here you are. There was no concept behind that, and they also did not. They also did not sing, but both these ladies are very great dancers, and it was just fun doing this. You know, I mean, practically everything we do was having fun. And when the famous Anton Corbijn was present at our video shoots, in his wonderful Dutch language, he always came to me and said, "Dieter, this is chaos. This is total chaos. How can you do this?" And this was exactly what I did. I had a 16 millimeter camera. By the way, this was my first movie that I did, and I was invited even to the Cannes Festival because they had to open their doors to experimental stuff. And so I used the camera like a brush, so to speak. And the beautiful thing was that whatever I did with that camera, I couldn't see it immediately, But I loved the idea to do crazy things with the camera and then be happy to see it when it came back from the lab and it showed what had come up as a wonder. You know, of course, I had a certain routine by the time, but it was really making fun of throwing this camera in the air, of having single shots, of having superimposed shots. And it was not an interpretation of our music. It was something that was kind of, how should I say? It was an additional nice combination, but it was not that I tried to interpret Boris's sounds or our music and then made a video of that. The videos were as crazy as everything I did.
I mean, going along with that, you said earlier about Boris's music as a cinematic experience. So what did that allow you to contribute in a wider sense? Because you'd made films with sounds before, and I wonder whether it gives you a wider palette that you can contribute on.
Yeah, I mean, Boris was kind of skeptical at the beginning of my contribution as a filmmaker, but at the end of the day, he started to like it, that his contribution, which was major, of course, this was something separate. It was not an interpretation. Boris would never accept an interpretation. It was like very distant from his music. And as I told you, we were flying in a balloon and we did all kinds of funny things. We enjoyed the experiment of the rhythm and the paintings of Boris and to edit then in a positive way what had come out. But there was no concept, there was no script. There was maybe one idea, like you might remember Pinball Cha-Cha, you know. We had a pinball machine somewhere in our studio and Boris was just a pinball virtuoso. And it was very funny that he was sort of performing and he proposed that he should sing or kind of sing with my voice. You know, Pinball Cha-Cha was Boris Blank as a musician and as a kind of he used my rhythms and I loved it. I loved it that he was everybody thought that was Boris singing, but it was my voice and it was an overdub that he did it. He was a Pinball Cha-Cha freak.
Looking for a fun way to win up to 25 times your money this basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projected stats, and place your entry. You could turn $10 into $250. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/fan and use code FAN. That's code FAN at prizepicks.com/fan.
Must be present in certain states. Visit prizepicks.com for restrictions and details.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
Right now at Safeway, save on all your favorite home scents and cleaning products for a fresh, clean home. Shop for deals on items like Glade candles and plug-ins, Febreze air fresheners, Clorox cleaners, Swiffer wet cloths, or Scotch-Brite sponges. Plus, deck the halls and shop for deals on items like mini light sets, holiday wrapping paper, holiday candles, and holiday cards. Offer expires December 26th. Restrictions apply. Promotions may vary. Visit Safeway.com for full offer details.
That was from the second album, but I just want to talk about the first album. You mentioned a bit earlier about Bostich, and that became a hit in the dance charts in America. How did that come about?
Well, that's a really long story. The funny thing was that this Bostich, which makes no sense. Bostich in German is like when you have a machine that puts paper together. And the funny thing was that somehow one of our vinyls, and we probably produced about 1,000 or something, ended in the hands of Frankie Crocker. This is Frankie Crocker at WBLS. And he played it upside down. He had about 60 or 70 FM stations. And artist friends of mine in New York, they said, Dieter, this is your band, right? It's Yellow. They're playing it 8 times a day on each station. And the interesting thing was that this was only so successful in the Black community. And of course, immediately when we had this surprise success, nobody bribed anything to be part of a WBLS show. You know, it was purely occasional that we ended up in that very important show for Black people. The record companies didn't have to spend a lot of money for the promotion of what we did, and everything came out of the blue. We signed quite important important deals, you know, because the record companies were happy that they didn't have to play a lot of promotion money, you know. And then they said, the guys that we had to deal with, that he wanted us to do one show in New York or two shows, which we did at the Roxy, and only colored people came to that show. And there was a lot of really crazy stuff happening. Like, it was at one point there was a total cut of power. Everything was dark. Boris was afraid what had happened. He jumped like under his synthesizer, and it was a very funny situation. For about 5 minutes there was no electricity anymore, but we somehow finished. And the second show was quite okay. And when we walked out, it was like in the middle, like a boxing ring, and we were protected by big colored people. And the other guys, they came up to us and they always said, oh, we love it, pizza, everybody pizza party, everybody pizza. They understood, instead of everybody meet somebody, they understood everybody pizza party. And out of this misunderstanding, this became a huge hit, because nobody would sing a song like, everybody pizza party, sometimes. So this was crazy for these people, but it wasn't pizza party, it was everybody needs somebody sometimes, you know. So there's a lot of coincidences that made Yellow a successful band.
How have you maintained a Yellow sound over the years, when there's been so many electronic bands that have come after you, yet from the first notes of Yellow, from your voice, obviously, it's so identifiable as Yellow. So how have you maintained that sound, and as a different sound from everything that's come after you?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, this you should ask Boris, who, of course, was always, who was jumping into his own world and was surprised what was happening. You know, this is why the process for him as producing an album always takes so long. because he jumps into the same sand pitch maybe 100 times until he is happy to release it. And I'm the total different guy. I'm a, like, for example, in Standing at the Machine Every Day for All My Life and most of the other songs, it took me maybe an hour to write the melodies and the lyrics, not even writing it down, just improvising a lot of it. And when it was okay, it was okay. And but I always surprised me that something came out. And also, I used my voice, of course, for different sounds, like, oh, yeah, you know, oh, yeah, chigga chigga. And this, I was like a chameleon, you know, that because I could do with my voice a lot of things. I could use my voice like an instrument, you know. I was never a great singer, but obviously the special way I did it was accepted by a lot of people. They thought it was very funny. Oh, yeah, chica chica.
How much do you think the contribution of yours to the visual image of Yellow has helped maintained the unique identity of the band?
We never had a problem. I mean, as I told you before, we were always surprised, especially when Boris confronted me with his fantastic music. We were surprised like little children who loved to play, and suddenly something was there that they liked, you know. And we, as I told you also, we had really a lot of fun. Boris in his own way, you know, building his sound castles, and Dieter as a speculator, what he could do, what happened to him when he was performing. It came to a situation when Boris went to have lunch, and he just allowed the sound running. And by the time he was back, I could propose I wouldn't even call it lyrics, but some sort of sounds to him. And especially this Standing at the Machine Every Day for All My Life, Boris thought at the beginning that this was absolutely not what he expected from that sound that he had created. And at that time, I only had half a tape spur, you know, and when Boris was not happy with it, we had to erase it. It was the time when a singer always had like very little room. And then I insisted that I didn't want it to erase it because it was a lucky punch. And the sound engineer, whose job, of course, it is not to comment, but he said, Boris, this is quite funny what Dieter did here. And this is how Boris then went home and said, okay, when you don't want to propose another melody or another song, then my day is over. He took the cassette and went to all kinds of different bars, and everybody was mesmerized by this track. And finally, Boris believed that it was not so bad to erase it, you know. But that was actually one of the few times that Boris was really not happy with my so-called singing. And this was, of course, one of the tracks that really made a big band out of Yellow.
The album You Gotta Say Yes to Another Excess was the last album to feature Carlos Peron, and you haven't really mentioned him yet. But was there a struggle for expression within the band at that time?
I never realized that. And Carlos Peron, he was more like an early type, how should I say, a friend of Boris, maybe it's even a little bit of a producer he wanted to be. But he came to a point when Boris didn't want to continue to work with Carlos Peron, and Carlos Peron went for his own way, you know. But he was a separation which clearly had to come up sooner or later, because Boris really wanted to be on his own. He didn't want to have anybody around when he produced his music. So Peron found his own way and his own style, and the band was split. But even when we worked together, the contribution of Perón was minimal, but nevertheless, Boris liked it to have this guy in the studio. It was a good symbiosis, but not so far on the musical side, but just on having somebody who enjoyed his music when he was working.
I mean, once, you know, when Carlos left and then you made Stella, that was when, you know, the hits really came in with Oh Yeah and Vicious Games.
Yeah.
And so do you put that down to the fact then you were really able to, or Boris was really able to complete the music on his own and you were able to contribute your part as well?
99% of whatever happened to Yellow was Boris Blank and my voice. And the fact that Perón left, was of no importance at all, you know, it had nothing to do with our breakthrough. As you know, it is always an alchemistical wonder if a little band from Switzerland has a worldwide situation and millions of people liked our sounds and maybe even a little bit my voice.
Now, you worked with Billy McKenzie over the years, mm-hmm. Of the, you know, of the Associates, Party Fears 2, which was a track that I adored in the early 80s. What had been your connection to him before you worked with him? Was it through his music that you knew him? And how would you describe his talent from working with him?
Well, his talent was enormous. He was probably the nicest voice of pop music of all, yeah. And our manager at that time in England, Ian Trigoning, he was kind of a friend
Billy McKenzie.
Of Billy McKenzie. And Billy McKenzie, first of all, he also was singing for Boris, but most important was the contribution of Shirley Bassey, because Shirley Bassey couldn't read notes. And Boris insisted to work with Shirley Bassey, Billy McKenzie. He didn't compose a track, but he was singing for Shirley Bassey, listened to McKenzie. And I was coming back from somewhere in Europe. And by the time I was back home, sort of 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the whole song was already done and Shirley had sung about three or four absolutely beautiful versions. And to this very day, I still like her song, and she still performs this song in her shows.
Yeah, no, it's an absolutely beautiful song. On the Flag was The Race, which was an 8-minute track. And there was a video that was created of stock footage. Can you tell me about that video that you created and the attention that you were trying to get across?
Well, again, you know, it was totally improvised. Of course, there were some relationships with the song, you know, like, but there's no big secret and no real composition behind this. I just Patricia Fontana, she did a marvelous job as a dancer. And Boris was an incredible comic in this performance when he was sitting in his he was just on a chair, and the whole thing turned out to be funny that he wasn't even sitting in a car. But the rest, as I always told you, is just by coincidence. You know, this was, we just again enjoyed to have fun with that track. And the funny thing was that a German company that had a video show, they were looking for a soundtrack, and they didn't like what they got sent. And then they asked Boris, and Boris said, "I'm not going to do this." And then he did it with a piece that he thought was not that interesting, but he delivered it and became a very famous track from him. What was the name again? The race, of course. But it was a big show was on, And this also helped to make us famous.
Now, you've also become an entrepreneur and in your life. So how much creativity is in entrepreneurship?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's I was more like fascinated by certain ideas of certain guys or certain women. And when I thought it was interesting, I started to collaborate with these people. Sometimes it was interesting, and sometimes it was just something that once you are in that, once you, you know, I produced the first Euphonics console. This was the first fully automatic console. And it was very expensive. I spent a lot of money. And at the very moment when we, when the big companies were working with our console, like out of seven Oscars, six were won with our console, and I was happy. I thought this is now like a breakthrough. And then an incredible thing happened that the CNN had a speech by George W. Bush, and the guy who was mixing this, he was very interested in listening to two ladies who were sex adventures, and this went over the speech of George W. Bush, and it was a huge scandal in the whole United States. Now the CNN guys, they came to us and said, look, you have to take this on your own mistake. We look like total idiots. If you don't do that, we are not working with you anymore. So poor company said, okay, in which case we have to admit that it was a mistake, which was not true. Not only did CNN still work with us, but also a lot of other big companies who had bought or were about to buy our consoles stepped back and said, well, here we see this analog console still is not reliable and we don't want to work with it. And this was the moment when I had to give up. You know, I was happy to get 60 cents to the dollar back, but it was a big loss and really a very depressing situation, because I had the first console ever and the best console, and I had to give up because as the reason was that I was not able to go back again.
So then what has poker given you in terms of your entrepreneurial dealings?
Well, you know, poker is like when, how should I say, poker is poker. You know, each time you have a new hand, you can play your game. And it's a new world you get each time in poker. But if you are an entrepreneur, like now, I created a big chocolate enterprise. And once you say yes to this, there is no way back. You know, in poker, you have a new hand every 3 minutes. You know, but if you are fascinated by the cold extraction of the cocoa bean and you make a much better chocolate, then there is no way back. You know, there is you have to follow up even when things get difficult. I had all kinds of very tough situations with that. Now we are happy to, after 3.5 years, have this factory done. And some of the big players, like from Starbucks and like from Barry Callebaut, the biggest players, are very interested in us. And Howard Schultz even allowed that I could have in his roastery center a first test of what this chocolate did. And the chocolate did very well. And now we have another big or two big chances in Manhattan. And if this works out as well, then I'm happily invited to produce my chocolate for 5 or 10,000 people.
It's amazing. I mean, everyone I talked about when I said I was going to interview you mentioned Yellow's music and chocolate. So I think you're definitely onto something there. The process is something that doesn't heat the cocoa. Is that correct?
Yeah. Of course, you know, the old way to produce chocolate is they use a lot of materials that come from outside. That nothing is natural. The butter is just absolutely no flavor in it, and the product is an artificial product. In my case, I have everything from the cocoa bean, even the pulp that is inside the cocoa fruit. I use this to give more sweetness in it, but of course it's much, much better, this kind of sweetness, than all the other sugar bombs that are being used. And the industry at the beginning, they were laughing at that, what I was doing, because they did not want to change their approach in factories. But once they heard that I'm close to Howard Schultz and that he said, Dieter, your product is absolutely outstanding. We are in business. They didn't take me seriously, but now they come my way and they ask, could we do this and that? And could we work together? And I have one or two companies with which I work, but let's see what's happening. But I also had a very difficult time. You know, it was really tough till this whole machine was working.
I hope I pronounce this right, but Hoyo de Agua, your ranch in Argentina, what impelled you to start that and what does it give you on a personal level?
Well, even as a little boy, I worked as a farmer. I loved it to be helpful for farmers on the Lake of Zurich. And my dream always was to have a big piece of land and to produce organic products. And in 1996, for a long time, I couldn't go to Argentina because of this very, very bad time when they had the dictatorship of these crooks and murders. You know, they murdered dozens of people who were like not following the gangsters. They were true bad people, and I couldn't go there. And in only 1996, I went to Argentina again, and I found a first situation with 2,500 hectares and a very beautiful old rundown house. And this was exactly what I was looking for. Over the years, I renovated that house and I was able to be a little profitable. And I then started also with grapes, and I started with nuts. And in the meantime, I have about 60 or 70,000 hectares with all kinds of products. And this is for me probably the biggest joy of whatever I did. You know, it's so fantastic when you see things growing and you're doing a good job because you're honest and you have no chemicals and all the rest of it. For example, at the Rio Negro, left and right, there is it's a very dry area. Nothing really grows there, but you can take the water out of this wonderful big river. And on water channels, you can bring the water to the trees or to the or to the beans or whatever. You know, it is a very big and interesting adventure what you can do when you build your channels. Or sometimes you even pump the water out with the solar panels. You know, we take the water out, and we have wonderful water there and very, very good products. And I'm totally happy that I can spend the next 2 or 3 months of the year in Argentina. And I'm happy when my chocolate company now does a good job. But by the way, my eldest daughter took over the business, and she's a very precise and a very nice person. And I can give this to her and she will do a great job.
You're a very wealthy man, but what does wealth mean to you?
First of all, I'm not very wealthy. And second, it is, as I told you, not different from my way of music. I'm just interested in finding new ways. And when I see something that could be interesting, I dive into that, and I have to do it. You know, it's not that I want to be a rich man. It is when I make money, I invest more money to have more land that is being productive with organic, 100% organic situations. Yeah? So that is what makes it. I could have stopped working whenever, you know. But it was never the issue that I would do it as a matter of having a lot of money.
You mentioned the word coincidence quite a lot in this interview, and I know that is an important thing in your life. And I want to say at the end that I'm very grateful that there have been so many coincidences that have led you to have the life that you've had, because you've contributed so much to popular culture, which has been part of all our lives. And I think I speak for so many people that we're internally grateful for your musical, your visual contribution over the years, and I can't wait for the chocolate. So, Dieter Meier, I want to say at the end, thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, I have to thank you, and you had so many interesting questions, and of course my English is sort of limited compared to my mother tongue, which is of course German, and I hope you could use some of my statements. And especially today, I had a complicated morning, and I was not at the top of my capacity, but I enjoyed your questions, and I hope that you can work with it.
Dieter, ich kann alles mit das machen. Es ist überhaupt gar kein Problem. Dieter Meier, danke.
Well, if you send me your address, I can send you some chocolate. And there is only one disadvantage. If you have tasted my chocolate, you will never taste another chocolate again.
I totally believe
that. You get a total addict. You have to live with that. Yeah? Okay.
That's the addict I can live with. Brilliant. Okay, Dieter Meier, thank you again. Bye.
Thank you.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.
Looking for a fun way to win up to 25 times your money this basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projected stats, and place your entry. You could turn $10 into $250. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/fan and use code FAN. That's code FAN at prizepicks.com/fan.
Must be present in certain states. Visit PrizePicks.com for restrictions and details.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch."
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.